welcome to another installment of Setting History Straight. My name is Joey Thompson. I'm located in Flintstone, Georgia. Linda Watson is, of course, our very knowledgeable history host. She is coming to you from New Orleans, Louisiana. Linda, how are you doing, and what do you have for us this evening?
Yep. Hello, Joey. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Hope everything's well with you and your family.
Thank you.
Last week we were talking about how Europe was settled and who was in Europe, and we talked about how Noah settled into Europe and took his family and colonized all of Africa, and he wound up in Italy. And we talked about Shem picked up where Noah left off, and he brought colonies also into Europe. And we also today want to let people know what happened in Europe and who settled it, because we are trying to explain the migration of the Israelites into Europe. And so we want to know who was actually in Europe before then. And one of the people that was in Europe were the tribe of Judah. And this is not known by many people. I gave you some verses earlier, Joey, and I wondered if you could read for us 2 Kings 18:13 through 15, I think 15 or 16.
You know, I can do that. It says, verse 13, it says, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up against Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong, turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. And the king of Assyria addressed Hezekiah, king of Judah, assessed him 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Yahweh and the treasures of the king's house. Verse 16, at that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple, from Yahweh, and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria, Sennacherib.
Now, it's interesting that the first verse, I wanted to give y'all some background. That first verse that Joey read, which was verse 13, it says, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, the king of Assyria came against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. So we normally think of the captivity of Judah being when, Joey, somewhere around 587 to 585, depending on the particular milestone,
right?
But around that time frame, right?
Early 6th century, yes.
Right. So Sennacherib really was also the king that took Assyria, took the northern tribes, and they fell in 721 BC. So the 14th year of Hezekiah was around 714, between 710 and 714. We can't tell exactly when, but sometime in that time frame. And the Austrian Chronicles, the history of Austria, they actually have listed all of their kings and information. And the last entry into that chronicle was in the 14th century AD. So for years, they kept adding their kings and their history into this Austrian chronicle. Well, they mentioned that the tribe of Judah was taken to Austria and put in Austria, and they settled that area, and they were brought there by the Assyrian king. So, which makes perfect sense, because we always wondered how the tribe of the Jutes, J-U-T-E-S, which is a tribe that we have always recognized was the tribe of Judah, where they came from. And now we know, it's so unbelievable that the European history has been left out. And now the tribe of the Jutes eventually worked their way into England. And, they become part of of the British Isles. And that's the history most people don't know about the Jews, or the tribe of Judah, I should say. And I thought that was a fascinating when I found that out. And I found that in the compendium by Herman Hay, who was a historian that wrote, I guess, around the 1930s, 1940s. He mainly was known for his history of Egypt. But I just, you know, we read these things in scripture and we think that Judah fell in 585 BC, which they did. That's when Jerusalem fell. But some of the tribe of Judah was taken out before then, which I think is really interesting. But we also want to pick up and talk about the history now of the land of Israel in the century before, well, century and a half before the time of the Messiah, because we're working our way through history as a series. And we're going to talk about the Maccabees a little bit today and find out some really interesting things about the Maccabees. Just to back up a little bit, we know that the tribe of Judah was taken into captivity. They went into Babylon, and Cyrus issued an edict about 538 BC allowing Judah to return and rebuild the temple. That actually didn't happen to the time of Darius. Only 50,000 people returned, because most of them wanted to stay in Babylon and they had become Hellenized. So when I say Hellenized, that means they took on some of the teachings of the Greeks. And one of the reasons is that the Alexander the Great, and we want to pick our story up with Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great went into Jerusalem, but he did not really, I would say, conquer it or take it or seize it the way most rulers do, because the people in Jerusalem already knew he was coming, and the high priest had a dream the night before Alexander got there, and he dreamt that he would be received by Alexander, and there would not be anything for him to worry about, because he thought he was going to be put to death. And he went out with an entourage and met Alexander the Great outside the city of Jerusalem. And the most amazing thing happened, Joey. Alexander got off his horse and he knelt before the high priest. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, it fulfilled the dream that the high priest had had. I thought that was just really interesting. But getting into more of this, the high priest actually showed Alexander where he was written in scripture in the book of Daniel. For the audience, Joey, can you tell people where Alexander is written in the Bible?
Sure. Daniel, the 8th chapter is where he first is introduced. And, it gets into verse 20. It says, the ram which you saw, I'd check and make sure I was unmuted. The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Mede and Persia. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn between its eyes is the first king, and that would be Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, the four kingdoms arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And of course, that's talking about the four kingdoms that would come out of Alexander the Great's kingdom, one of which became Rome.
Now, you know, there's been many movies written about Alexander the Great, none of them being accurate. They picture him as a homosexual. He was married. He had a child. I think he may have even had more than one wife, but I know he had at least one. He's it's just about everything they picture him as. He was clairvoyant. We know that he was clairvoyant. That was one of the things that helped him when he went out to battle, because they said he could see beyond and know what was behind mountains, trees, and bushes. And I think that's incredible. The only way you can do that is to be clairvoyant. And when I say clairvoyant, in a lot of cases, that may mean that he was under some kind of demon influence, which makes, you know, perfect sense as to why he would know what was gonna, he was facing before he actually got there. And he, his kingdom, after he did die, he died like a very young age, 29 or something. And his kingdom was divided between four generals. And Jerusalem fell under the Ptolemies. So you have four different generals. Jerusalem and Judah fell under the general called the Ptolemy. And eventually the Seleucid Empire came in and took Jerusalem. And so it was under the Seleucid Empire for quite a time. And that's when we had the story of the Maccabees. Everybody knows the story of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I want to tell you in detail some of the stuff that he was doing. I'm just going to read a little paragraph here. As it says, Antiochus, the high priest, was merely a local governor and within his realm who could be appointed or dismissed at will. Antiochus pursued a zealous Hellenistic policy. He made possession of the Torah a capital offense. He burned copies that he could find. According to Maccabees 1, he banned many traditions, the Jewish practices. Jewish sacrifices were forbidden. Sabbath and feasts were banned. Circumcision was outlawed. Mothers who circumcised their babies were killed along with the families. Altars to the Greek gods were set up for animal sacrifices, and the idol of Zeus was placed in the altar at the temple.
That sounds like a Catholic church.
Well, you know, they do put statues.
Yeah.
So it was interesting because at that point in history, the high priest was basically a bought position. And now the high priest that was in Jerusalem when Antiochus Epiphanes came was Onias. And Onias lost his high priest position because his brother, Jason, paid more for it. So I think he paid like 300 talents of silver for the priest position. Then Jason worked as the priest office for 3 years, and one of his officials that he worked with was called Manelius. Manelius bought the high priest position. It was up to the highest bidder. And the next one also, they both tried to push in Hellenized views. Well, by that time, many of the godly people had just had enough of what was going on in Jerusalem. And that led to the Maccabean revolt, and this, we're going to just mention it. We're not going to give any large amount of details. A rural Jewish priest, Matthias, sparked a revolt when he refused to worship the Greek gods. What happened was he refused, and somebody else said, well, I'll just do it for you, and stepped up in his place. And Matthias took a knife and stabbed him. Him and his five sons ran and were hunted down, but one of them came back who was, I think his name was Julius Maccabee, and he came back, and he's the one that basically restored the kingdom back to the tribe of Judah. Now, after the victory, the Maccabees entered into Jerusalem in triumph, and they cleansed the temple and reestablished the traditional Jewish worship there and installed Jonathan Maccabee as the high priest. Well, Jonathan was assassinated by Simon Maccabee, the last remaining son. So even though this was a family, this particular family was in line to be a high priest. They were of the clan and heritage of Aaron. So they were in line, but each one of them, you know, when you hear the story, Joya, I think it's just incredible that these men would purchase their own kingship. I guess they had no choice. And then they would kill their brothers so they could become high priest.
Yeah, it was a different time.
I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, why would you want the position of high priest if you have to kill your own physical brother for it? It makes absolutely no sense. Well, Simon was the one that put Antipater the first in Idumea, which is a country that was over to the, basically to the southwest of Judah. And that's where the Edomites lived. And it says Simon was murdered in 134 by his son-in-law, here we go again, and was succeeded by John Hyrcanus the first. Now, we want to spend some time and talk about Hyrcanus, because Hyrcanus, I guess he was the one who brought a lot of territory into the land of Judah, and he annexed Idumea, which was the land of the Edomites. And he didn't stop at that. Joey, do you recall what he actually did to the Edomites?
I do not. You stumped me on that one.
Okay. Well, John Hyrcanus is the one who forced the Edomites to be circumcised.
That's right.
And
yep.
To accept Torah.
Yep.
And that's never been Yahweh's way. He always wanted us to set an example for people, and they learn from our example. And they see our blessings and learn from our example.
And that led to the Edomites having power during Messiah's time, did it not?
Yeah, it does, and I'm going to lead into that because we're going to talk about some of that.
Great.
The temple in Mount where the Samaritans were, that was also demolished. And I want to read you a little bit about what Josephus has to say about the Edomites. They had occupied by that time southern Judah, and they were 19 miles from Jerusalem. It says, this country is also called Judah, and the people Jews, and their name is given to them, as many embrace their religion, Judaism, which of other nations. But upon the foundation, so good a governor as Hyrcanus took upon himself to compel the Edomites either to become Jews or to leave their country and desert great consideration. I suppose it was because they had long seized on the possession of the tribe of Simon, that's the land of Simon, by the way, and all the southern part of the tribe of Judah, which was a particular inheritance of the worshipers of the true God without idolatry. Now, here's a quote from a historian. His name is Bernard L. Comparet, and it says, so the Edomites were driven westward. Now they couldn't go southwest or straight west, therefore strong enough to fight the Egyptians, so they went slightly north and west and took over southern half of what the kingdom of Judah is and settled there. So now we know they were in the southern area of Judah. Now, the Jewish Encyclopedia on Edom, they were then incorporated with the Jewish nation, and their countries were called by the Greeks and Romans Idumea. From this time, the Idumeans ceased to be a separate nation, though the name Idumea still existed in the time of Jerome. So what he said is there's a blending of the people here. And that's one thing that we need to also know. And I'm going to make one more quote from Josephus. And it says, the Edomites lived 19 miles from Jerusalem. The first century historian Josephus tells us that they were hereafter no other than the Jews. They were mixed in with the Jewish people. I wanted to ask you if you would mind, we just want to tie in on the last thing that we were covering. If you could read Esther 8:17 for me.
You know, I would love to do that just as soon as I can get back there. I moved my Bible. Esther is in my Bible.
That's somewhere.
I apologize.
Now, Esther, by the way, was written during the around 519 to 465. We know that because she married Xerxes.
Okay.
And so that's what time Xerxes lived.
Verse 17 says, "And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because of the fear of the Jews fell upon them."
Okay, so this was a common practice after their captivity was to mix with the people in their area. And this is what scripture tells you. Now, does it not just say that? And many of the people of the country declared themselves Jews for fear that the Jews would fall on them. They feared the Jews so that, and Jews were always a mighty group of warriors all through history. Always have been. And it's interesting that your wife talks a lot about the Benjamites. And did you know that the Benjamites were the ones that settled Galilee? Because that was the area that they settled. Because, you know, the Benjamites stayed with the Jews.
So the disciples would have been primarily, if not all, Benjaminites.
Well, I know that at least three or four of them were Levites. But I'm assuming the others were probably Benjamites. Could have been a very strong possibility. Because they came from that region, didn't they?
Yes.
Now, they also had a little settlement of Greeks and Syrians in that area also. So, but I think they were mainly, Israelite background. And so we're going to stop right here because we need to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the Pharisees. Now, I just want to remind you, if you have any comments, questions, or want to see my research, you can go out to my website, which is 12tribehistory.com, or you can email me at lwatson44@cox.net. And with that, we're going to take a little break.
You're listening to Setting History Straight with Linda Watson.
Now, we want to pick up and talk about Pharisees, and who they were and what their teachings were and just a little bit about them. Now, we were talking about Hyrcanus, and this is when the Pharisees came into history. They were in existence before them, but Hyrcanus had a real problem with the Pharisees. And it stood from the fact that he made himself not only king, but we would call governor, but he was also the high priest. And he went in to do some of the duties of the high priest in the temple, and the Pharisees threw oranges at him. So it's actually the truth. And he never overed that. He had such a strong hatred for the Pharisees. And at some point, he killed a large number at a special event. And, and they were, at that point, they were in charge of the temple. But the reason they were upset with him is they did not like the way he was conducting the services for the holy days in the temple. Now, the interesting thing that I found out when I studied the Pharisees is there was only, at the time of Christ, there was only 6,000 Pharisees. Now, that's according to the Britannica. They said there was 6,000 Pharisees and 4,000 Essenes, and then it says a very few Sadducees. Now, Sadducees were the ones that really were in charge of the temple at the time of the Messiah. And Pharisees' responsibility? Do you know basically what they did, Joey?
Well, the Pharisees would have been the teachers of the law, if I understand that correctly. The Sadducees...
They taught oral law, too, by the way.
Right.
They taught the oral law.
The Sadducees were always sad because they didn't believe in the resurrection, so they were sad, you see.
part about the Pharisees only being 6,000, I just assumed that there was much more than that. But apparently it was that's the size. And remember now, the area of Judah was like over 2 million people.
So you're saying there were 6,000 Pharisees strictly in that area
at the time of the Messiah.
I would have thought it would have been much less. I would have thought, yeah, maybe 1,000 or less. That would have been my thought, but what do I know?
I just thought it was a small number, but apparently that was the size of it. And well, the Sadducees were even much smaller.
Well, the power comes from small people. You know, it doesn't take a large group of people to hold sway over a larger group of people, so.
Right, and that, especially since these were the people that set themselves up with the oral law. We all know how the Messiah felt about the Pharisees and the Sadducees both. But one of the things that was mentioned in the Encyclopedia Britannica is the Mishnah, which is the first component part of the Talmud, which was written about 200 AD, was incorporated from the oral teachings of the Pharisees on the Jewish law. Now, there's no doubt that's where it came from. It was nailed down.
And let's be clear.
Messiah did not approve of the oral law of the Pharisees. Let's
so
make
what,
that real clear.
So what you're saying, Linda, is these were Edomites. Is that correct? They had nothing to do with the house of Israel.
No, I never could find out. I never found out that the Pharisees were Edomites because they were mixed. So, I mean, you had some in there. Now, I'm going to mention a little bit later about Herod because Herod killed all of the Sanhedrin and replaced them with his people, which his handpicked people, and most of those were Edomites. So people at the time of the Messiah were a lot of the people in the religious circle that were teachers and leaders were probably Edomites that sat on the Sanhedrin. But the Pharisees, no. That's not necessarily the case of the Pharisees. Remember, Paul was a Pharisee. Gamaliel was a Pharisee. And both of them were of the school of Hillel. And the Hillel school was the one that was the more, one that didn't teach oral law. So I think it's interesting. The Pharisees, there was a mix of the people with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but it was the Sanhedrin that was basically the Edomite.
Interesting.
At the time of the Messiah. Couldn't find out who composed the Pharisees, but I knew that there was a mixture there. And you now remember, not all the Sanhedrin was going to be Edomites either, because you had Joseph of Arimathea. You know, he was on the Sanhedrin. But anyway, getting back to our story here, John Hyrcanus planned that upon his death, his wife would take charge of the civil affairs, and his son Judas would be the high priest. When Hyrcanus died in 104, Judas imprisoned his mother and members of the family except for Antiochus. Now, here we go again. This family was something else. Now, this was still the rightful heirs to the high priest position because they were from the family of Aaron. And it also says that Judas had himself crowned king, and in the year he reigned, he seized Galilee and compelled all the inhabitants of whom were in Syria and Greek descent to become Jews. The same kind of practice, trying to force people to practice the Jewish religion. That was never, you know, Yahweh's way to force people to practice their religion. It was always supposed to be something that people recognized and wanted to become. God doesn't want people forced to believe something, and it doesn't work. That's the main reason when you force people into something that they don't want to do, it doesn't work. Now, the son of Hyrcanus had another son named Janus. And Janus came in and took the realm from his brother, Judas, and put him in prison and shipped him to Rome, and he waged war against the Pharisees. Here we go again. But it was his wife, who was named Salome, who took his place after Janus died, and she restored, she felt sorry for the Pharisees because Janus, her husband, had been so cruel to them. In fact, at one point he killed 6,000. And she restored them to their rightful position and gave them rulership. At that point, they were in charge of the temple. Which, you know, it kind of looked like Joey, they passed it back and forth between them and the Sadducees. But at the time of the Messiah, you know, the Sadducees were in charge of the temple. And It's important to know that the Pharisees were in charge of what? The synagogues. So, I mean, now, Queen Salome, she had another name. Her name was Alexandra. But she had two sons, and for some reason, they named these children the same names, Hyrcanus and Judas, which was the two former, you know, the two former kings or governors. Now, Hyrcanus was weak, and he was the older one, so he was anointed high priest during his mother's life and became king after her death. But these two boys were at each other's throats for the right of succession. And Hyrcanus took the throne, and he had his advisor, Hyrcanus, named Antipater. Now, Antipater, if you remember who he was Herod's grandfather. And that's how Herod worked his way into the governorship of the land of Israel. He was appointed by Hyrcanus, the son of Salom. Now, civil war broke out in between these two brothers. And the younger brother, Judas, he controlled the temple area. And it's interesting, they worked out this little plan where they would still allow the daily sacrifices to take place. But at one point, one of them brought a pig into the temple. And they said that the clacking of the heels of the pig was heard 400 miles in all directions. I would imagine so. That seemed humorous to me. But the civil war got so out of hand that the citizens of Judah asked Rome to intervene. And this is how Rome got involved in Jerusalem. Pompey was the Roman emperor. Remember that Rome was ruled basically by what we call triruvant. That means three emperors. Cassius was one who the Parthians slew. And then you had Pompus, who was really controlling the eastern half, and Julius Caesar was controlling the west. Well, there was a rivalry going on between Pompey and Julius Caesar. And of course, if you were a guessing person, Joey, what do you think that would wind up being? Of course, Julius Caesar came out on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into Jerusalem after he took control of Rome as the supreme ruler of Rome. And he put Hyrcanus back into the high priest position. But guess who he made governor? Antipater.
Oh,
Antipater. Antipater went behind his governor and bought the position from Julius Caesar. You remember he was an aide. He was an aide in the beginning to Hyrcanus, because Hyrcanus was the governor. Well, Antipater, who was an Edomite, went in and bought that position from Julius Caesar, and he became the governor, and Hyrcanus became the high priest. Well, that, you can imagine how well that sat. And this was the practice, that whoever had the money, you know, they were the ones that were able to purchase the position. It's amazing how that happened. So, Joy, do you have any comments you'd like to make? I hadn't had a chance to ask you if you have any comments.
Yeah, the only comment I have, Linda, is if you haven't already done so and put up on your page, you need to make like a family tree of this, what you're talking about, to help people understand. It is tough to follow. So if they had something to look at, that might be good. So.
And that's a real good idea. I have an article out there that explains some of this, but a family tree would probably help a lot, because it was changing hands so quickly that it was all based on the purchase of the positions. That's what was going on. Now, everybody is familiar with Mark Antony. After Julius Caesar died, Mark Antony took over Egypt. You know, he was married to Cleopatra. And there was a strong relationship between Antony and Herod. And Herod is the one that would now come to play, and he would be the governor. He would be appointed the high priest in the beginning and governor. But he never did take the high priest position because he knew he was not of the line of Aaron. Now, he thought that if he could if he could marry into that line, that would allow him to become high priest, but he never did take that position. Lucky for him. He married into the same family which he married Mariana, and that was the sister to some of the two brothers that we just mentioned earlier. And the interesting thing about Herod is that he was an extremely paranoid individual. He strangled his firstborn son, pretended like he invited them all over for a party and asked them all to go jump in the pool to swim, and he had him strangled. I mean, in the water. He was always suspicious of everybody around him, and he was highly influenced by his sister, and they keep using the same names. Her name was Salome also. And I think that's kind of interesting that she had the same name. She was extremely wicked and wanted to stamp out all forms of Judaism. And she wanted to push in a Hellenistic culture into Jerusalem. And she wanted to destroy all the remaining family members that were the Maccabean line. And so Marianne, and she still had a brother. She talked her brother Herod into killing the brother in the very beginning, which didn't set well with Mariana. And then she convinced Herod that Mariana had committed adultery with her uncle Joseph. And eventually this led to Mariana being put to death by Herod. So he was a violent man. Everybody around him seemed to die. And we all know the story about how he killed the 2-year-old sons at the time of the Messiah, because he was worried that the Messiah was going to come and take over his throne. Now, in 40 BC, the Parthians invaded Palestine. A civil war broke out, and Herod was forced to flee to Rome. The Senate nominated him as the king of Judah and equipped him with an army and made a claim. But the Parthians ruled Palestine for 3 years until 37 BC, and they put Antiochus on the throne, and he stayed basically in power for only 3 years, actually, when Herod returned with an army and took back his throne. Now, of course, Antiochus was killed after that. He had him beheaded. Now, there's a real good book on Herod. It's called Herod the Great, and it's put out by Jerry Noblet. And an interesting thing about it is that he mentions the entire life of and how paranoid Herod the Great was. He was a very brutal man. So one of the first things he did, and I mentioned that earlier, is that he killed the entire Sanhedrin. You know, the Sanhedrin, now that people may not realize that the Sanhedrin was made up of two parts. There was two Sanhedrins. The Sanhedrin, there was one that was 26 people that was made mainly a religious body, but then there was the Great Sanhedrin, and they had different men that served at different times in the Sanhedrin. And there was two different groups, and they were called the Hodales and the Shammies in the Sanhedrin. And so you had a mixture of people in there, and some were, the Shammies were the ones that believed in following the oral law, and the Hodales did not believe in following the oral law. And from that's basically, at the time of the Messiah, it was the Shammies that were in charge at that point, and that's why the Messiah was basically found guilty. I mean, that's basically what happened there.
Hmm.
I just think that's really an interesting story, because you have so many people that, you know, you just would not know all these circumstances. Now, when Herod went to die, and this is a story that's not been told, and I think it's interesting to tell, Salome, his sister, had all the descendants of David gathered up and brought to Jericho and put in a circus. So that Jericho had this big arena, and they called it a circus. And they were going to celebrate Herod's death by killing all the descendants of the tribe of David. But someone got wind of what was going on, and they had rounded them up. They were in the very hour Herod was to die. They were a number of people found out and foiled the plot, and the people that were of David's descendants were able to get loose from the circus and get out. And so they weren't killed. It was going to be they were going to have a big celebration for his death by killing off all the descendants of David. Can you imagine that? Unbelievable story. So, Joey, would you like to make any comment?
I find it interesting that, you know, we open the pages of the New Testament, and it's almost like we're walking into a movie that's already begun, and we really do not have adequate information to know what led up to Messiah's birth, to the power that was, who held the sway of power during that time. And so that's the reason this information is so important. So, you know, I think it's wonderful. I just wish I had a better grasp on it. I would probably have to go back and listen to this program two or three times. And the visual aid of a family tree, not only for on the Edomite side, but also the Maccabean side, would definitely help a lot.
I like that suggestion, and we're definitely going to do that. Now, you know, I think what we try to do in this program is give you a historical background so that when you do read the Bible, you have a better understanding of what's going on at the time. Because I will tell you this, that the history lines up perfect with the Bible. And as we go and all of this unfolds, we're able to see this information. It's just amazing. Now, it looks like the clock on the wall says it's time for us to go. And if you have any comments or any additional information on tonight's program, anything about this subject that I covered, if you'd like to share it with us, you can contact me at my website. My website's called 12, tribehistory.com. 12tribehistory.com. Or you can email me at lwatson44@cox.net. And if there's, Joey, if you have nothing else, this is Linda signing off for next.
And good night.